Okay, welcome everyone to another Tuesday afternoon on Shake and Wake Radio. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this is Cancel the Cabal. First thing I did want to say, first I got a funny little story after I try to help Annie out get some donations. She has things coming up at the end of the month. Don't know what they cost, but she sure could use a little bit of help out there. I helped her out a little bit yesterday, and hope somebody else can too. Bills come due, and if you like the content, please do try to help Annie out. Anything would be appreciated. Hit that donate button if you can. As I mentioned, pick Cancel the Cabal on Shake and Wake Radio, also on EPGN Radio, PSN Radio, and SoFlow Radio. Glad to pick EPGN back up. anybody wants to go on the station, they can hit me up, and I can get you connected with Rob Morris if you want to get connected. Do some content. Get your message out there, whatever the case is. Okay, the funny little story is today is opening day of gun hunting season for deer, and my stepdad got a doe just not very long ago, probably about 2 p.m. somewhere in there. He come home and said he needs some help getting the deer out of the woods. So I said, no problem. We got the deer all loaded up in the back of the truck, and we started to head back to the house. The field where he hunts at is just across the road, not more than 3,000-4,000 feet, less than a half a mile. So we just drove the truck right over there, and he's been hunting there about the better part of 35 to 40 years, somewhere in there. And we got almost all the way back to the end of the field. And he said, wow, there's a dog out here. I looked at that, and that sucker was big. I said, that's no dog. That's a cow. Finally, he looked at it again. We got closer, and it ended up being somewhere juvenile, probably a good 700-pound cow. Maybe it was born at the beginning of the year. I don't know. I don't know how fast they grow and how big they get. Some cows get 1,200-1,300 pounds, but there was this cow almost next to the road, not but a couple hundred feet from the road, and she was just meandering out there in the field looking for corn. Corn just got picked, and he spent about another 15 minutes trying to get her. He thought if we have a fenced-in field, fenced in our yard there, if we could get her back to the house there, we could fence her in and try to find out who owned the cow. She got out from somewhere. Yeah, exactly, Luca. Moo. Moo. Exactly. But ended up calling the sheriff, and we tried for about 10 minutes trying to get her lassoed with a big, thick rope, and she came right up to me. I started talking to her, and she came right up to me and sniffed my hand, but we couldn't get a rope around her neck. She was too wise to it. So hopefully the did end up calling the sheriff, and hopefully they found out whoever it was. I've been in this area for, well, better part of my entire life, and I don't recall seeing any cows, not from a long, long ways away, at least a few miles away. But hang on a second. Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, that's my funny little story. Exactly, Luca. Moo. I'm going to continue on reading The Truth About Contagion, Exploring Theories of How Disease Spreads by Dr. Tom Cowan and Sally Fallon Morrell, his co-writer or dictator, whatever she did. Oh, got to get my readers. That's one thing. I cannot read without them. I might be able to, but I don't want to hold my arms out 2.5 feet away. Try to read. I'm going to go back one paragraph to go over last week's reading. Just as a little reminder. Since remdesivir gave disappointing results, health officials are seeking other remedies. One suggestion is dexamethasone, a potent steroid that can shrink the brain. Dexamethasone makes sense if COVID-19 is an inflammatory and inflammation rather than an infection. In fact, one of the first things medical students learn is that steroids like dexamethasone make infections worse. Since dexamethasone may make COVID-19 better, this demonstrates that the illness can't be an infection. Well, you're welcome, Mom. Another proposed treatment is the drug Haldol. Haloperidol. Sometimes called vitamin H. Haldol is one of the most potent antipsychotic medications in existence. It puts the patient in a kind of drooling stupor. Doctors and scientists from France report serious effects when non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs, such as ibuprofen are given to COVID-19 patients. NSAIDs can cause internal bleeding, as do ACE inhibitor blood pressure medications. That's nice. Official policy states that no coronavirus drug is universally safe and effective and discourages non-toxic or holistic treatments. But the lack of successful treatments from mainstream medicine has patients seeking alternatives. A report at the end of March brought attention to the work of Dr. Vladimir Zelenko, a New York physician who claims to have treated almost 700 coronavirus patients with 100% success using a malaria drug called hydroxychloroquine sulfate with supplemental zinc, a treatment that costs only $20 over a period of 5 days. Success is probably due to the patient receiving zinc and sulfur. A study published on May 22 with great media attention in both the Lancet and the New England Journal of Medicine claimed that the treatment was useless and warned that it could possibly cause death. But on June 4th, The Lancet retracted the study and apologized to its readers. The study was withdrawn because the company that provided the data would not provide full access to the information for a third-party peer review. Based on this development, we can no longer vouch for the veracity of a primary data sources. Dr. David Brownstein reports, or is it Brownstein? I don't know. I never can tell. It's probably both. Dr. David Brownstein reports no hospitalizations in 85 patients diagnosed with either COVID or suspected COVID using vitamins A, C, and D, hydrogen peroxide, and iodine, while advising patients to avoid the flu vaccine. Ozone is another promising therapy. Other proposed alternative treatments include acetazolamide, altitude sickness drug, hydrogen peroxide IV, vitamin C, or maybe that's hydrogen peroxide 4, I don't know. The Roman numeral levels for 4, or is it IV? Vitamin C IV, hyperbaric oxygen, hydrogen gas, and chlorine dioxide. But none of these are available in hospitals. hyperbaric chambers are. They're in wound treatment therapies, clinics. So that's not... well, they... I'm almost sure that they would not possibly ever let that be used for COVID-19 or anything else except for wound treatments. After Memorial Day, COVID-19 hotspots flared in Arizona, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Florida, which officials blamed on relaxed mitigation efforts. Having fun at the beach or visiting bars, not wearing face masks, and not practicing social distancing. According to one official, there are certain counties where a majority of the people who are tested positive in that county are under the age of 30, and this typically results from people going to bars. Are these new cases simply due to increased testing with many false positives? Or to the Wiley virus infecting people with person-to-person transmission? Or to the continued deployment of 5G technology to smaller cities and to the Southwest and longer exposure to 5G as the weeks and months go by? In mid-June, government agencies could point to an increase in cases in Texas, Alabama, and Virginia. The findings indicate that the risk for large sound waves of outbreaks remains low and communities continue to implement cautious, incremental, planned reopenings that limit crowding and travel to non-essential businesses. Without vigilance in masking, hygiene, and disinfection, certain southern counties will remain high risk. Health officials warned that opening states too soon could have disastrous consequences. In early July, Texas reversed course and mandated masks. Not sure what you're thanking me for, but you're welcome, Mom. Campaign social sharing. Although increased testing with the useless PCR test has undoubtedly generated higher numbers of COVID cases, hospitalizations have also increased. The curve has not flattened. It's going up again. Hospitalizations have gone up in California, in spite of strict masking and social distancing measures there since early in the year. Sweden initially appeared as a bright spot among nations by forgiving a mandatory lockdown with factories, businesses, bars, and restaurants remaining open, and a lower illness and death rate than other European nations, whereas tourism came to a halt in the rest of Europe. It flourished in Sweden. However, case numbers and deaths began to rise in April, with the total number of deaths now over 5,000. Was this because Sweden failed to follow lockdown and mask mandates? I gotta stop here and blow the eight just for a few seconds here. No, it's probably because they, like everyone else, they changed the definition of a COVID death, or they made everything COVID death. That's what it was. Or was it the rollout of 5G beginning in March? An April 6 article stated, Sweden is in the process of introducing super-fast 5G mobile telecoms networks, giving users several times faster web speeds compared with existing 4G technology. Sweden's first COVID-19 death was March 10. The fact that no explosion of cases occurred in large cities after the Memorial Day protest has puzzled health officials. Areas of unrest like New York, Chicago, Minneapolis, and Washington, D.C. did not see any increases in cases, even though thousands of protesters did not wear masks nor practice social distancing. Of the 13 cities involved, only Phoenix saw an increase in cases and hospitalizations, which officials blamed on a decision to end Arizona's stay-at-home order and ease restrictions on businesses. Arizona residents who were cooped up for 6 weeks flooded Phoenix area bar districts, ignoring social distancing guidelines. The wily coronavirus apparently zeroed in on these law-abiding citizens, but not on protesters crowding the streets. The official government policies for curtailing COVID-19 are self-isolation, social distancing, hand washing, surface cleaning, environmental hygiene, and face masks, because coronavirus can spread by just talking or breathing. You're in danger if you're 5'11" and 3/4 inches away from somebody, but 6 foot away, you're safe. And the virus also knows when you're sitting down in a restaurant or standing up. That's the smartest virus in the world. I keep telling everybody that. Coronavirus can spread by just talking or breathing. The only recommendation treatment for those in an acute stage of infection is ventilation. Anyone ever seen a virus that smart? I know, that was a rhetorical question. No one needs to answer. The official government policies for... I just read that, sorry. Many have pointed out that the pores in even the best face masks, even the N95 respirators, are 10 times larger than any virus. A study published in May 2020 in Emerging Infectious Diseases reviewed the evidence for the effectiveness of non-pharmaceutical personal protective measures and environmental hygiene measures in non-healthcare settings. Sorry, the word was split up on two different lines. The evidence from 14 randomized controlled trials of these measures did not find that hand washing, environmental hygiene, or use of face masks had any effect on reducing transmission of so-called infectious diseases. What's more, labels on boxes of masks specifically warn that the mask will not provide any protection against COVID-19, coronavirus, or any other viruses or contaminants. That's wonderful. Moreover, wearing a mask can cause serious adverse health effects, including headaches, increased airway resistance, carbon dioxide accumulation, and hypoxia. I've told everybody I've had hypoxia before, and I'm not going to get it again. And I've had pleurisy before, and I'm not going to get that again either. Especially the tight-fitting N95 respirator mask developed headaches, and 60% required pain medications for relief. Wearing a mask can cause a reduction in blood oxygenation, hypoxia, or an elevation in blood CO2, hypercapnia. The N95 mask, if worn for hours, can reduce blood oxygenation as much as 20%, which can lead to a loss of consciousness. The Occupational Study and Health Administration, OSHA, warns that masks risk creating a low oxygen environment and are not effective in preventing disease. Recently, two boys in China fell dead wearing masks while running during physical education classes. Nevertheless, Los Angeles officials have decreed that Angelinians must wear a face covering while outdoors. The new law requires face coverings for walking, running, cycling, scootering, roller skating, skateboarding, and all other activities except for those on the water. Yeah, the loving people of California. They just love you so much. The leaders of California love you so much. A recent review of the science relevant to COVID-19 social policy concluded that masks and respirators don't work. No randomized controlled trial study with verified outcomes shows a benefit for healthcare workers or community members in households to wearing a mask or a respirator. There is no such study. There are no exceptions. Likewise, no study exists that shows a benefit from a broad policy to wear masks in public. Furthermore, if there were any benefit to wearing a mask due to their blocking power against droplets and aerosol particles, then there should be more benefit from wearing a respirator N95 compared with a surgical mask. Yet several large meta-analyses and all the randomized control trials prove that there is no such relative benefit. As for social distancing, health officials have put a guilt trip on the whole world by warning that asymptomatic carriers, those who carry the virus but have no symptoms of disease, could fuel the spread of the disease by stealth. This virus is going to win an Academy Award. Or no, Nobel Prize. That's what it's going to win. Just the greatest thing in the world. An article published at greenmedinfo.com lists 13 studies showing that social distancing increases mortality in heart patients, and those with diabetes, causes depression, and generally shortens life. Moreover, such policies do no good. In June, Dr. Maria Van Kerkhoff, head of the WHO's Emerging Diseases and Zoonosis Unit, announced, from the data we have, it still seems to be rare that an asymptomatic person actually transmits onward to a secondary individual. As for environmental sanitation, some of the guidelines border on the ridiculous. One article suggests that flushing the toilet without a lid could spread coronavirus. Well, they did say it can be transmitted through flatulence. That's what they said one time. And they even tried to indicate that it could be spread through staring at somebody. One article suggests that flushing the toilet without the lick. The theory is that through flushing one's stool down the toilet, it gets aerosolized into the air. Obviously, you can't transfer the virus to yourself, so it's not a big deal if you watch the contents of your toilet get flushed away. And members of your household have already been exposed to your viruses. So the real risk is that those who invite groups of strangers to watch their stool get flushed down the toilet. Citizens are warned to refrain from this dangerous habit. Yeah. They believe we are just absolutely dumb. They believe we're as dumb as rocks. That's what I believe. Even, I'm going to wait. I'm going to go to the first break here, so. Oops, I marked my spot. Okay, everyone, let's see here. I guess maybe about close to 6 minutes for a break. Be right back, everyone.
This song is for all of those whose names are there, and for all of those who risked having their names there on the wall.
I saw her from a distance as she walked up to the wall. In her hand she held some flowers as her tears began to fall. Then she took out pen and paper as to trace her memories. Then she looked up to heaven and the words she said were these. And he meant so much to me. And oh, I'd love to see him just one more time, you see. All I have are the memories and the moments to recall. So Lord,
Okay, and I'm back after the first break there. I do want to say again, please consider helping Nanny out with the bills that she has coming in at the end of the month. Please give, please donate if you can. Annie, I don't think that you ever must have had much fun when you were younger in the snow. Little story, my mother, she left one job. I don't remember. I think it was the telephone company. She worked there when I was a little kid, and then she worked at Montgomery Ward's when I was little too, but she worked one winter at a ski lodge in my area here. And, oops, hang on a second. Got a message somewhere else. Oops, no more. Oh, well. I got to ski for free. Got to learn how to ski for free for a whole winter. And I was able to take advantage of it because she worked at a ski lodge. Got lessons for free. Got to use all the equipment for free. So that was fun. And we had snowmobiles when I was a kid too. Getting able to snowmobile in the out there in the weather that out there, well, it was just fun. Got to do all the stuff fun in the winter. So you had to have liked winter to have done some of those stuff like Luca was trying to tell you. Yeah, there you go, Mom. Right there. Even though the science does not support social distancing and the use of masks as a way to control disease, school officials are seriously proposing masks and social distancing for grade schoolers when they return to the classroom in September. I wonder what year this was made, printed. Oh, it says 2021. Okay. Guess it doesn't have a month. Must be the spring or summer. The school district of New Albany, Ohio, has taken such policies even further. In addition to mask and social distancing, the school district would require each student to wear an electronic beacon to track their location to within a few feet throughout the day. Oh, that's just so nice. The device will record where students sit in each classroom, show to whom they meet and talk, and reveal how they gather in groups. These devices could also be used on younger students who do not have smartphones. To compile all the data from tracking beacons, the schools will need the kind of powerful Wi-Fi service that only 5G mounted inside the buildings can supply. Gee, imagine that. Only 5G can save you from what it's causing. Without the virus theory, and even with the virus theory, masks, social distancing, and lockdown make no sense. Ironically, to avert 5G and EMFs from cell phones and other devices give us good reason to avoid crowded situations. Take choir practice for a few dozen people in close quarters, most with cell phones in their pockets and possibly a cell phone tower in the church steeple that is in perfect situation for creating illness in electronically sensitive individuals. Think meatpacking plants where hundreds of people standing at close quarters, all with cell phones, possibly with 5G installed inside the building to track product. And the added electro smog stress of conveyor belts and the constant whirring electrical machinery. workers in small plants, typically located in more rural areas and lacking conveyor belts and other electrical equipment, will be less vulnerable. Think schools, office buildings, universities, and stadiums, where 5G is planned, and indeed has been installed covertly under the guise of disinfecting. During the coronavirus lockdown, the new wave of illness predicted in September is likely, with students going back to classrooms newly wired for 5G, and again, most with cell phones, or imagine tens of thousands crowded in a stadium, now fitted out with 5G to everyone, can use their phones. Verizon is building its 5G Ultra wideband network to support transformational changes across multiple industries, including sports and entertainment, said Kylie Malady, Horizon's chief technology officer. This next-generation technology can enhance the fan experience with the potential to revolutionize the way sports are viewed and played. Faster download speeds, higher bandwidth, and lower latency on 5G-enabled mobile devices with Verizon's 5G Ultra wideband service is just the beginning. Outbreaks of illness in factories, schools, theaters, and stadiums are sure to happen, and will appear to confirm to contagious virus theory. Health officials who have predicted a second wave in September will have the satisfaction of being right, and the justification to proceed with their promised solution, a vaccine. Chapter 13, A Vaccine for COVID-19. The story of vaccination begins in 1796 with Edward Jenner of Gloucestershire. I guess that's how you pronounce it. Somebody from out east. Mark and Annie would probably know. That sounds about the way they have some weird pronunciations out there. Gloucestershire. I think it's in England, but I'm not positive. Oops, I just had a screen go dark on me. Turn back on. Edward Jenner of Gloucestershire, who administered the first vaccine against smallpox. At that time, many country folk observed that dairymaids generally had beautiful, unmarked skin, proof they had never contracted smallpox. The reason, some claimed, that their exposure to cowpox said to be a mild bovine variation of smallpox. Their exposure to cowpox, said to be a mild bovine variation of smallpox, gave them immunity to the human form of the disease. Some country folk believed the superstition that after a case of cowpox, you could never get smallpox, a belief contradicted by the observations of physicians at the time. What are you going off about there, Luca? Of course, there is a far better explanation for the beautiful skin of milkmaids. Unlike most people of the time, they had a daily access to a superb source of nutrition, including a rich source of vitamin C and nature's premier probiotic food. Good nutrition, including good probiotic, protected milkmaids against diseases like smallpox. Good nutrition protects all of us from disease. Of course, preventing bed bugs with good sanitation also plays an important role. But it is likely that milkmaids slept in clean beds. If they did get bitten, the superb nutrition of their milk-based diet protected them.
On May 14th, 1796, Jenner tested his hypothesis on inoculating James Phipps, an 8-year-old boy who was the son of Jenner's gardener. He scraped pus from a cowpox blister on the hands of a milkmaid and scraped the pus into the arm of the child. Jenner excelled at self-promotion, and in 1802, the English government awarded him £10,000 for continued experimentation. Gloucestershire. Okay. Jenner claimed that his vaccine gave perfect immunity for life. Unfortunately, statistics taken from reports of the Register General of England indicate that the vaccine was not a success, with deaths from vaccination outnumbering deaths from smallpox through the early 1900s. In 1831, a smallpox outbreak in Wurttemberg, Germany, claimed the lives of almost 1,000 people who had received a vaccination, and in the same year, 2,000 people vaccinated in Marseille, France, developed smallpox. In 1854 through 1863, following the introduction of compulsory vaccination programs in Europe, smallpox claimed over 33,000 lives. And other epidemics followed, epidemics in which thousands of vaccinated people died. Compulsory vaccination laws in England were repealed in 1907, but by that time their failure too obvious to disguise. During one of the worst smallpox epidemics in England between 1870 and 1872, the city of Leicester. Leicester? Is that how you say that? Chug? Took a different approach. They instituted a system of good sanitation and quarantine, with the results that there was only one death from smallpox in Leicester. I'm guessing that's how that's said. During the epidemic. Hey, I got one right. Louis Pasteur followed in Jenner's footsteps with the development of a vaccine for chicken cholera, which didn't work, and for anthrax, which was forced on many farmers who reported that their sheep died anyway. And finally, in 1855, for rabies, also called hydrophobia. The premise was that if you could create a less virulent source of disease and inoculate that into a healthy person, the person would develop immunity and not get sick when he encountered the full-blown illness. Even in Pasteur's day, physicians doubted that hydrophobia was a specific disease. Dogs became vicious through starvation and neglect, and neurological disease leading to insanity could happen in the aftermath of any kind of wound, especially a punctured wound. The most likely cause of rabies is a form of tetanus or botulism. Both are associated with Clostridium, toxins that the bacteria produce under anaerobic conditions, as in puncture wounds. Doctors in Pasteur's day had excellent results treating dog bites by cauterizing them with carbolic acid. One doctor reported cauterization of about 400 dog bite victims without one developing a case of hydrophobia. Close to sheer. Oh, is that an Irish accent or a Scottish accent?
thick Scottish accent. Aye, lad.
But Pasteur believed he could prevent rabies by vaccinating the victims of dog bites. He created the rabies vaccine by taking saliva, blood, and part of the brain or spinal cord, usually the cerebral spinal fluid, from a suspected animal and injecting it into a live rabbit. Then aging and dyeing the cells from the rabbit's spinal cord so that it could be injected into human beings. Who's leaving? Oh, sorry. Sorry for wherever you're going. Oh, Luca's gone. Good night, Luca. Good day. Whatever. Drying the cells from rabbit's brain, okay, into human beings. His first patient, a badly bitten 9-year-old boy, received the vaccine after a doctor had cauterized the wound and recovered. Pasteur proclaimed his success, but others were not so lucky. A Dr. Charles Bell Taylor, writing in a publication called National Review in July 1890, listed many cases in which Pasteur's patients died, whereas the dogs that had bitten them remained healthy. One of these cases was King Alexander of Greece. In his own reports, Pasteur fudged the numbers to make them seem as though he had a high rate of success. In the practice of medicine, sometimes the dogma about a certain subject becomes so rigid that even when the truth is sitting in plain sight, physicians can't simply see it, such as the case when it comes to the concept of permanent immunity of infectious disease. Medical students are taught early in their training that our immune systems are organized around the principle that if we get an infectious disease once, we will never get it again. That is supposedly due to the two phases of our immune system working together to create the memory of a virus or bacteria that lasts for life. Scientists have worked out the intimate details of this immune memory over the last century in order to provide the theoretical basis of vaccines, for vaccines. The immune theory also derives from the simple observation that nobody gets a typical childhood disease twice in their lives. Like many ideas in medicine, however, the truth may be far more complicated. I gotta put something else on my YouTube here so my screens don't go black on me. Give me just a few seconds here. I guess this one's okay. Now I gotta find my spot again. Two simple observations cast doubt on the premise of immunity for life. The first is that certain bacterial diseases, such as strep throat, do tend to reoccur. In fact, there is no immunity for life construct when it comes to bacterial infections. As for viral infections, we can easily observe that most people get numerous colds and flu throughout their lifetime. Scientists usually explain this by saying these are just different viruses. One catch, and just because you are immune to one doesn't confer immunity to other viruses. And it's still difficult to switch these pages. We also know and generally accept the facts that a child who gets chickenpox is susceptible later in life to a second manifestation of chickenpox called shingles. Shingles is believed to be caused by the same virus but with a different symptom picture. Similarly, many people have experienced repeated bouts of cold sores or herpes outbreaks, so there is no lifelong immunity in these cases. Interestingly, at the same time, Pasteur and others were formulating the germ theory of disease, along with its corollary of immunity for life. Many scientists and physicians disagreed. One of the dissenters was Professor Alfred Russel Wallace. In his book, The Wonderful Century, he had the following to say about smallpox. Very few people suffer from special accident twice, a shipwreck, or a railway, or a coach accident, or a house on fire. Yet one of these accidents does not confer immunity against it happening a second time. I'm going to throw lightning strikes in there too. People have been hit several times with lightning. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, if not thousands. The taking is for granted that second attacks of smallpox or any other... Zymotic disease. Z-Y-M-O-T-I-C. Zymotic. Are that degree of rarity as to prove some immunity or protection indicates the incapability of dealing with what is a purely statistical question. Wallace describes a study by Dr. Adolf Vogt, professor of hygiene and sanitary statistics at the University of Bern, Switzerland. Vogt compiled data on those who had contracted smallpox and their subsequent susceptibility to further smallpox episodes. He found that those who had one episode of smallpox were eventually 63% more likely to suffer from a second episode as compared with those who had never had a case of smallpox. Vogt concluded all this justifies our maintaining that the theory of immunity by a previous attack of smallpox, whether the natural disease or a disease produced artificially, can be regulated to the realm of fiction. Wallace went on to prove that people vaccinated against smallpox actually had a much higher death rate from smallpox than did those who were not vaccinated. In particular, Wallace studied the high death rate from smallpox in heavily vaccinated soldiers in the U.S. military compared with results obtained from the sanitation methods employed by the town of Leicester in England. Here is what Wallace concluded. It is thus completely demonstrated that all the statements by which the public have been gulled for so many years is to the almost complete immunity of the revaccinated Army and Navy are absolutely false. It is all what the Americans call bluff. There is no immunity. We have no protection. When exposed to infection, they do suffer just as much as the populations or even more. In the whole of the 19 years, 1878 to 1896, inclusive, unvaccinated Leicester had so few smallpox deaths that the Registrar General presents the average of the deaths by a decimal, 0.01 per thousand population, equal to 10 per million, whereas during 1876 through 1889, there was less than one death per annum. Here we have real immunity, real protection, and it is obtained by attending to sanitation and isolation, coupled with almost total neglect of vaccination. Neither Army nor Navy can show us such results as this. And I'll take my second break right here, folks. So, let me find a... I don't know. I guess about a 5.5 minute. Nope, I've done played that song already. About a 6 minute song here, everyone. Be right back.
Because
Okay, and we are back after the break, the second hour. Final hour. Looks like we picked up a few listeners there, Andy. That's good. So, welcome to the new listeners, or the whomever it is. Clearly, protection through vaccinations for diseases like smallpox is an ugly superstition that must be discarded. At the same time, we must abandon the concept of lifelong immunity conferred by the activity of our immune system. But what about the observation that children essentially never get measles twice in their lives? In this case, there is so little actual study of this phenomenon that it is difficult to make any firm conclusions. But we must remember that the typical childhood diseases such as measles, mumps, whooping cough, and chickenpox are best understood as precursors of normal growth and maturation of the child. If this is the case, there would be no reason for children to go through these processes more than once in their lives. After all, a tadpole transforms into a frog only once. A caterpillar becomes a butterfly only once. Measles is a process of detoxification, transformation, and growth. If thwarted, particularly by an injection that clearly alters our immune responses, then only worse things can happen. This is clearly revealed by many studies showing that children who go through typical childhood illnesses, such as measles, have fewer chronic diseases throughout the course of their lives. The body likely becomes a chemical or protein that we call an antibody to mark this event. But it is far from clear that antibodies are protective of anything, and that these childhood diseases are contagious. We must have the courage and insight to rethink this whole concept of disease. For the pharmaceutical companies, however, the concept of introducing a small amount of bacteria, viruses, or toxin into the body to create lifelong immunity supports the practice of vaccination. And by the early 20th century, they were having a field day producing vaccines for any disease they could think of. American soldiers made convenient guinea pigs and complained in letters home of receiving a vaccination every week. Many have surmised that the effects of the Spanish flu were exacerbated on military bases by all these vaccinations inflicted on the troops, including a crude bacterial meningitis vaccination experiment, another factor that resulted in the high death toll among American. Soldiers was the use of aspirin, often in huge doses, which undoubtedly contributed to the excess hemorrhaging that carried so many away. The process for creating modern vaccines involved many trade secrets and numerous ingredients. Unknown to the public is ongoing controversy over which process produces the best and safest results, because serious reactions into vaccinations are commonplace. When one understands the basic of how all modern viral vaccines are manufactured, however, it becomes immediately clear that I was getting a call here. I'm gonna have to let that go. When one understands the basics of how modern viral vaccines are manufactured, however, it becomes immediately clear not only how fraudulent the whole process is, but also how the production of modern viral vaccines helps prove that these viruses can't possibly be causing the diseases for which they are blamed. To produce a modern vaccine, technicians first collect biological fluids from an infected person, usually respiratory secretions or the fluid, and skin lesions. This presumably contains millions of copies of the virus, along with an untold number of components from cellular debris. The fluid is then centrifuged to concentrate the virus. The next step is to inoculate this centrifuged fluid into a variety of tissue cultures, usually tissue derived from monkey kidney cells, aborted human fetal tissue, or chicken eggs. Some companies have proposed using cancer tissue as a culture due to the fact that cancerous tissue is easier to grow in large amounts, but this practice is still considered too risky. It turns out the viruses that supposedly will kill us all aren't strong enough to infect the tissue cultures. This means in order to help the virus taken from a sick patient, kill the tissue cells. They have to starve and poison the tissue first. Once the tissue is weak enough, the virus can then infect the cells, inject its genetic material into the cells, and produce millions of copies of itself. That's the theory, anyways. The resultant infected tissue is an unholy mixture of the original snot, not frozen and distorted across the globe to all the various vaccine manufacturing companies as their stock material. The toxins, antibiotics, oxidizing agents, etc., used to weaken the tissue. The debris from the breakdown of the tissue and the viruses that emerge from this process. There are often some light purification steps added at this point, but never anything even remotely approaching isolation and purification of the viruses. Then finally, some preservatives, usually mercury for multi-dose vials, still used for the flu vaccine, and stabilizers just such as polysorbate 80 and emulsifier that breaks down the blood-brain barrier are added to this final product. This is a live viral vaccine. A dead or attenuated viral vaccine is all of the above steps and then a final heat or chemical sterilization step at the end to kill or at least neuter the virus. Never mind that one can't say viruses are even alive in any meaningful sense of the word. Nevertheless, they are killed, usually with heat. In this step, there's an adjuvant. Usually aluminum is added to the final product to make sure that the person receiving the mixture attempts to eliminate it from the body and so produces antibodies, considered proof of an immune response that will protect against the disease. Another way to make an attenuated or inactive viral vaccine is to start with dead, killed tissue. Then technicians isolate single protein particles from the dead tissue. Sometimes they even produce these particles synthetically. After that, they add adjuvants and preservatives, including aluminum. Aluminum added to the rest of this toxic chemicals is the likely culprit for the creation of the excessive inflammatory reactions that frequently occur with any attenuated viral vaccine, and are one of the central hallmarks of the COVID-19 syndrome. It would certainly be an interesting research project for someone to track the relationship between prior vaccine usage and subsequent development of COVID-19 symptoms in adults and children. The message that Americans get every morning in the newspapers and every evening on the news is that COVID-19 vaccine will save us, with mandatory vaccines for everyone. We can go back to life as normal, and scientists will have saved the day. The vaccine would be liability-free and rushed to market, making its debut in January 2021. Liability-free means that the consumer has no redress, no matter how bad the injury to himself or his child, no matter how costly the care after the injury. And it means that vaccine manufacturers have absolutely no incentive to make a vaccine that is either safe or effective. Even if a virus is the cause of COVID-19, manufacturers face a number of obstacles. For one, the virus already has mutated into at least 30 different genetic variants. The variants include 19 never seen before, as well as rare changes, and scientists have never imagined could happen. In addition, the challenge of producing so many vaccines in so short of a time is daunting. As described in an article published by Children's Health Defense, the solution proposed by pharmaceutical companies is a new type of vaccine that cannot outsmart nature using next-generation vaccine. Technologies such as gene transfer and self-assembling nanoparticles, along with invasive new vaccine delivery and record-keeping mechanisms like smartphone readable quantum dot tattoos, which will require the vast capacity of 5G networks to read and process. To quickly produce a vaccine for the whole world, they will also need to develop new manufacturing techniques that circumvent the slow processes of traditional vaccine production. The new technologies use genetic engineering, recombinant DNA technology, subjected to expression, symptoms, bacteria, yeast, insect cells, mammalian cells, or plants such as tobacco, to produce so-called subunit vaccines. The problematic hepatitis B vaccine was the first to employ this entirely new vaccine production approach, and the number of COVID-19 vaccines currently under development are deploying these techniques. However, subunit vaccines must be bundled with immune potentiating adjuvants, most likely aluminum, that can trigger an inflammatory immune response. Even newer are DNA and messenger RNA, mRNA, vaccines, which are basically a form of gene therapy. Whereas traditional vaccines introduce a vaccine antigen to produce an immune response, which doesn't actually mean that the recipient is immune. Nucleic acid vaccines instead send the body instructions to produce the antigen itself. As one researcher explains, the nucleic acids cause the cells to make pieces of the virus, so that the immune system then mounts a response to those pieces of the virus. DNA vaccines are intended to penetrate all the way into a cell's nucleus. According to one biotech scientist, this is an incredibly difficult task, even that our nuclei have evolved to prevent any foreign DNA from entering. Maybe nature has a reason for protecting the nucleus from genetic invasion. maybe. When some DNA vaccines made it into clinical trials in late 2020s and the late 2000s, they were plagued by suboptimal potency, meaning they didn't work. Scientists then came up with the idea of augmenting vaccine delivery with electroporation, electric shocks applied to the vaccine site using a smart device, to make cell membranes more permeable and force the DNA into the cells. Electroporation remains a key design feature of some COVID-19 vaccine candidates today. A second aspect of DNA vaccines, their gene-altering properties, is also troubling. DNA vaccines, by definition, come with the risk of integration of exogenous DNA into the host genome, which may cause severe mutagenesis and induced new diseases. Framed in more understandably terms, disruption from DNA is like inserting a foreign ingredient in an existing recipe, which can change the resulting dish. The permanent incorporation of synthetic genes into the recipient's DNA especially produces a genetically modified human being with unknown long-term effects. Regarding DNA gene therapy, one researcher has stated genetic integrations using viral gene therapies can have a devastating effect if the integration was placed in the wrong spot in the genome. Discussing DNA vaccines specifically, the Harvard College Global Health Review notes that the DNA vaccines could cause chronic inflammation because the vaccine continuously stimulates the immune system to produce antibodies. Other concerns include the possible integration of foreign DNA into the body's host genome, resulting in mutations, problems with DNA replication, autoimmune responses, and activation of cancer-causing genes. Think children with birth defects and cancer early in life. The mRNA vaccines are particularly suited to speedy development and have attracted attention as the coronavirus frontrunners. mRNA vaccines can reportedly generate savings of months or years to standardize and ramp up mass production. mRNA vaccines need reach only the cell cytoplasm rather than the nucleus and apparently simpler technical challenge, although the approach still demands delivery techniques that can ensure stabilization of mRNA under physiological conditions. This involves chemical modifications to stabilize the mRNA and liquid non-particles to package it into an injectable form. Unfortunately for the pharmaceutical companies, the mRNA vaccines have displayed an intrinsic inflammatory component that makes it difficult to establish an acceptable risk-benefit profile. mRNA enthusiasts admit that there is, as yet, an inadequate understanding of the inflammation and autoimmune reactions that may result from the vaccine. This raises a specter of a true disaster should regulators grant the manufacturers of COVID-19 mRNA vaccines their wish for a fast-track process to get mRNA vaccines to people sooner. (sighs) A good example of a rushed vaccine was the dengue vaccine experiment, which actually increased the risk of dengue fever. Dengue fever is a common disease in more than 120 countries and, like coronavirus, has been the target of a vaccine for many years. The development and licensing of Dengavaxia vaccine by Sanofi spanned more than 20 years at a cost of $1.5 billion. But the development of the vaccine turned out to be difficult. Dengue vaccine antibodies often made. The infection worse. Called disease enhancement. In vaccine speak, especially in infants and children. When the vaccine was administered to thousands of children in the Philippines, at least 600 died. The Philippine government has permanently banned the vaccine from the country. Another rushed vaccine was the swine flu. For the swine flu was a total fiasco. Early in 1976, after several soldiers become ill at Fort Dix in New Jersey, supposedly from swine flu, President Gerald Ford announced a plan to rush through a vaccine that so every American could be vaccinated. But manufacturers balked at the specter of liability for vaccine injuries, and one company produced 2 million doses with the wrong strain. Congress passed a law waiving liability, and Ford pushed the plans to inoculate 1 million people per day by the fall. Even though reports seeped through that the vaccine had caused injuries and was not effective, in mid-October, Ford went on television to show himself receiving an injection from the White House doctor. Meanwhile, the capricious swine flu failed to appear, and in December, following 94 reports of paralysis from the vaccination, the program was terminated, and the danger of swine flu disappeared from the pages of the newspapers. Amazing. Well, I'm going to mark my spot right here, everyone, and take the last break. Let's see here. I guess a couple of short songs add up to about 5.5 minutes, almost 6. Be right back in a few minutes, everyone.
Eternal, bright and fair. When the slave of earth shall. Don't let worries cloud your mind with fear. Pull your head up high in the early by and by. All your troubles soon will disappear.
You can move that mountain. You can move that mountain. Don't wait till tomorrow.
Your hopes and despair. You can find a way. Please believe in what I say. Troubles all will vanish.
Okay, I know Annie was dancing around, and probably a few others, too. Going to continue on about the last 25 minutes of the show. Please consider donating if you're able to. Annie's got bills coming up. And it wouldn't be surprising if the station had to shut down. Hate to see it happen, but it's happened before. Other stations I've been on. So far, trials for the coronavirus vaccine have not gone well. On May 18, 2020, Moderna Incorporated, co-owned by the National Institutes of Health, federal government agencies cannot own companies by law. Imagine that. Headquartered in Cambridge, Massachusetts, announced that it had obtained positive interim clinical data from a phase 1 clinical trial for an mRNA COVID vaccine. Moderna stock soared and their top executive sold off over $100 million worth of shares. However, 4 of the 45 participants suffered serious reactions. The 3 subjects who received the highest doses all experienced grade 3 systemic symptoms, which can mean blistering, open ulcers, wet peeling, or serious rash over large areas of the body. The press release did not mention the results of other trials. No, I didn't say nothing about quitting. I just said, if you don't have the money and you don't get the money, Annie, you might have to shut down. One volunteer, Ian Hayden, age 39, stated that the vaccine left him the sickest he's ever been. He was rushed to urgent care where he almost fainted. But Hayden is still curiously optimistic about the vaccine. The New York Times reported positive results from the vaccine in development by the University of Oxford. Monkeys given an experimental vaccine from the University of Oxford appear to have resisted the novel coronavirus. 6 rhesus monkeys given HADOX1 nCoV-19 in Montana did not fall ill despite heavy exposure, was the headline. But they did fall ill, in fact. All the vaccinated marquees sickened after exposure to COVID-19, suggesting the treatment, which has already received the region of 90 million euro in government investment, may not halt the spread of the deadly disease. An experimental vaccine for COVID-19 that uses human fetal cell lines in development by CanSino by Biologics Incorporated of Tianjin, China, also had poor results in the clinical trial involving 108 volunteers ranging in age from 45 to 60 years old. 81% suffered at least one adverse reaction within 7 days after the vaccination. Adverse effects included fever, fatigue, headache, and muscle pain. Some of it severe. Following these disappointing results, the FDA relaxed the rules. Yeah, if you're not getting what you need, just change the rules. On June 30th, the agency announced that any COVID-19 vaccine would have to prevent disease or decrease its severity in at least 50% of the people who receive it. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists also suggested testing COVID-19 experimental vaccines on pregnant women. And the officials tell us the vaccine might be needed multiple times, perhaps annually. And with every booster shot you get, your immunity goes down another 20%. Until you can't even... you have to live in a oxygen-fed bubble just to live. That's probably what it's going to come to. It's clear that a vaccine is not going to save us. In fact, it has the potential of inflicting enormous suffering on the world's populations, not to mention violent resistance to the idea of universal gene modification by electroporation, and all for an illness that is not contagious. Only two things are going to resolve the coronavirus problem. One is a new system of etiquette. Just a few decades ago, few people gave much thought about smoking in someone else's house. Today, such an action is considered the height of rudeness. Today, no one with any sense would light up in front of another person without asking permission, and certainly would not smoke in another person's dwelling place. Today, we are shocked to see men and women smoking in old movies. We all know that tobacco companies paid producers to show glamorous people smoking cigarettes, and we shake our hands in disgust. And we shake our heads in disgust. Are you kidding? 9 out of 10 doctors, they said smoking was safe, or 4 out of 5, whatever it was. I don't remember. They smoked right on live TV. All of the late night shows did it. All of the TV shows did it. And doctor said it was good, nutritious, and delicious for you. In the future, we will feel the same disgust when we see people in the old movies hold cell phones to their ears. How could filmmakers encourage such a dangerous practice? Like the warnings on cigarette packages, there will be warnings on cell phones against use by children. Sales of cell phones to young people will be forbidden, and no one will dream of entering another person's home with their cell phones on. Public pressure will ensue, and all large gatherings, sports events, concerts, fairs, conventions, choir practice, dress rehearsals, church services, and private parties begin their admonitions to turn cell phones to airplane mode. Yes, they did. Lucky strike. That was the commercial. Yeah, well, that, all of them. I can't remember Pall Mall. I'm trying to remember all of the cigarette brands. When I was 16, Annie, a funny story, my mother, she didn't want to go to the store. She just sent me to the store. I was able to buy her cigarettes at the age of 16. I bought her a carton of cigarettes and a 8-pack of Pepsi in the bottles. And she'd give me $5 and I'd return with change. And probably put some gas in the car too. I don't remember.
The second task involves a massive cleanup. Just as the Industrial Revolution created unsanitary conditions that took decades of patient hard work, as well as new technologies to amend, the wireless revolution will require the same patient remediation, mainly by putting as much communication as possible into wires, but also by exploring new technologies for mitigating EMFs in the home and office. New houses will be built with minimizing EMF exposure in mind. Are you kidding? They won't build new houses anymore. They're just going to build apartment complexes because everybody's going to be living in one. Not going to be able to own land anymore or have a house or a car, and you'll be happy. New houses will be built with minimizing EMF exposure in mind, and old houses will be upgraded. Just as old houses eventually got bathrooms and central heating, these measures are not as glamorous as introducing a vaccine that will bring fame and fortune to a few. But they are the only real solution to the electrosmog pollution of the internet age. And there is some good news. For years, the telecommunications companies have collected fees from your phone bill in order to bring high-speed fiber optics to every home, school, and business in America. Fees amounting to more than $5,000 per household and totaling billions of dollars. But instead of putting fiber optics everywhere, the job is only about 50% complete. These companies invested this money illegally to force people into wireless plans. Accounting tricks have made fiber optics services appear unprofitable, while wireless seems extremely profitable. Telecommunications companies, in collusion with the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, have used these distorted financial results to argue that they cannot bring wired internet to rural areas or even inner cities. More important than accounting tricks have provided to an excuse to shut off the wired networks and go wireless with 5G. Some communications executives have even proposed getting rid of old-fashioned telephone service. Fortunately, a recent court case, Regulators versus FCC DC Court of Appeals opinion, March 13, 2020, removes FCC jurisdiction and returns it to the state regulatory agencies. All illegal subsidies for wireless can now be stopped. And 5G is no longer profitable. Cool. That's nice. Chapter 14, 5G and the Future of Humanity. What piece of work is man? In Hamlet's famous soliloquy, Shakespeare poses questions about the nature of the human being, one of history's greatest initiates and thinkers. Shakespeare describes the human being as the crowning achievement of creation, free and unlimited in potential. Humankind is noble, created in the image of the Godhead itself, yet subject to all of the foibles, F-O-I-B-L-E-S, foibles, temptations, and errors with which we are all well acquainted. The question for this chapter, having previously explored the watery nature of life itself, is what or who is this human being?
The corollary to the question, one that is rarely asked, is why we should even care whether human beings will survive this current pandemic or whether we are about to go extinct, as have so many fellow animal species. In some ways, if we cannot begin to answer this simple but profound question, then what difference does it make whether or not there are pathogenic viruses creating contagions? To answer this question, what is a human being? Is actually the key to bringing the COVID-19 phenomenon to a successful resolution. It is the key to challenge the building of a world we all know is possible, but may be too afraid to pursue or even demand.
Just another thing about smoking and smokers. I didn't smoke, but I did the smokeless tobacco, the snuff, Skoll and Copenhagen and a couple of the others. I don't remember the names of them now, but I first started when I was like 13 years old in baseball because all of the sports stars were doing that kind of stuff. And it was like 29 cents a can, and cigarettes were about the same, 29 cents a pack or whatever it was. And 1989, they went up to 89 cents a can. And I said I was never going to pay a dollar a can. And like within a year, they went up to a dollar a can because the cigarettes went up to a dollar a pack. And I quit just before, or right when they went up to 89 cents a can, so I could buy a whole 10-pack of roll for, well, it would be $2.90 back in the 70s or whatever, and 89 cents when I finally did quit, $8.90 for a 10-pack, and I don't know how some people still pay that kind of a money. Out there on the East Coast, they're like $10 or $12 a can, or a pack of cigarettes. It's just crazy. It's crazy. Okay. When one tries to pinpoint the unique characteristics of human beings, many answers come forward. Some will say that this is a stupid or unanswerable question. Others might suggest the human beings are apes without hair, the only upright animal, or the animal with the largest brain. The scientists might point to our unique genetic makeup, the only living being with this particular set of 46 chromosomes. A religious person might say that human beings are created in the image of God, and as such are given dominion over the earth. The technologist might deny anything particularly special about human beings and point out our many design flaws, which he believes could be improved or upgraded by merging human beings with computers, creating a kind of download for our minds. Unfortunately for them, fortunately for the human beings, the technocrats have been unable to locate the human mind. I wonder if he means the our spirit or our soul. That's what they can't find. That's what they're never going to find either. These various descriptions all have certain elements of truth in them. Maybe not the download mind theory, but they all miss one simple and clear distinction. One that is inarguably
inarguable, and scientifically irrefutable. It is the one that holds the key of understanding COVID-19. The difference between human beings and all the rest of the animals is simple. The human being is the only living being that can beat children at every single time of the year. The human being is the only living being that can bear children. Good gracious, not beat. I read over that word too quickly. The bear children at every single time of the year. All other animals go into heat and become fertile only in specific times of the year, usually so they give birth in the spring. Wild animals go into heat once a year, and domestic animals, dogs, pigs, cows, etc., typically twice a year, and a few cats and rabbits several times per year. But human beings, at least at this point in our evolution, are able to conceive at any time of the year. People on Earth are conceived every single day of the year, and people are born every single day of the year. No animal can do this. What is the significance of this obvious fact? Significance. As we had discussed in Chapter 7, all matter is simply the congruence of wide and various forces or energies which make up our nature. Our entire universe, received or collected through the universal receptor we call water. The recognition of these universal energies or force was the basis of all traditional wisdom and healing systems until the current materialistic medical model came to the fore, and under which we all now labor. Traditional healers recognized the influence of the stars and planets. For example, they characterized chamomile, chamomile, as a Venus plant, stinging nettles as a Mars plant, and a dandelion as a Jupiter plant. Now that we understand the electromagnetic nature of the universe, these characterizations begin to make sense. This fundamental understanding was the basis of most human knowledge until it was lost in recent times. Although this way of looking at the world is key to our development as individuals, it needs to be rediscovered because the deployment of 5G technology threatens the foundation of existence. And we can understand why this is so only if we recapture the ancient way of thinking about life. Oh my goodness. I've got two more pages left and then the epilogue. So, I don't know how long the epilogue is. Not very long. Looks like I might finish out this book today. Not totally positive. There's an appendix. I don't know what this means. Appendix B. I don't know. I guess we'll just see where I'm at. Without getting too deep into the engineering of 5G technologies, the important thing about 5G is the pulsed millimeter waves. This new spectrum that will run our phones and computers faster need to be organized by placing hundreds of thousands of satellites right into the ionosphere of the Earth. Great. And that's what what's-his-name's been doing. Elon Musk. 20,000 of them so far, or something like that. I don't know how many. tens of thousands. These hundreds of thousands of satellites will emit their own electromagnetic frequencies that essentially beam these new man-made signals down to the millions of receivers placed in our neighborhoods, stadiums, schools, nursing homes, hospitals, parks, farms, lakes, forests, oceans, and everywhere else on Earth. The intention is to blanket the Earth with these man-made electromagnetic fields. We know that these millimeter waves interfere with the availability of oxygen in the atmosphere, and hence will also interfere with the ability of the mitochondria, bacteria, in our tissue to convert oxygen into energy. This is the main feature of 5G. Exacerbated by aluminum poisoning, glyphosate poisoning, general air pollution, and all the many other toxins in our modern world, all contributing to the symptoms of COVID-19. But none of this can match the consequences of putting hundreds of thousands of satellites in the ionosphere of the Earth. If this is allowed to happen, not only will all life on Earth be subject to constant toxic effects of these harmful millimeter waves, as if that isn't bad enough, but the direct consequences of this folly is that the cosmic waves that come to us from the furthest reaches of the cosmos will no longer be allowed to maintain their integrity in their journey to the Earth. Life will be cut off from the cosmos. Elk will no longer be elk. Squirrels will have lost the energetic source that makes them squirrels. Human beings will no longer be formed as free individuals with their own unique destinies. Life will become formed under the influence of computer code written by the self-styled new masters of the universe. And all this so we can have faster download speeds for our cell phones. Humanity is in the crossroads, and although we can present mitigation strategies that transform the energy fields to constitute the 5G technology, we should be clear, COVID-19 is the first wave of disease created by the introduction of this new technology. It is the only tip, it is only the tip of the iceberg. Officials warn us that more waves are coming. They know they are replacing the wisdom of God with the folly of man. It's time for humanity to wake up, grow up, and to find the courage to stop this menace. And I think that's enough for the day, because I'm going into the epilogue. After I sign off here, I'm going to find out how many pages are in the epilogue. So, no song at the end here, Annie, so I'm just going to drop all of the drop all the streams for you and say thanks for coming out, everyone, and hope to see you tomorrow.